Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Welcome and thank you for joining us today. The next 2 hours are devoted to learning something more, not just about the world of shoes and ships and sealing wax, but about how, what, and why we believe as we do. A time for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know, who we are, and who we might become. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. Now, if you're listening to this show live, then tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and this year, it is also the first day of Hanukkah here in the United States. The last time the two holidays overlapped was in 1918, and it will not happen again until 2070. I don't think I'll make 27. I don't know. Thanksgiving is chiefly celebrated in the United States and Canada, and this year, families who celebrate Hanukkah will be able to come together and celebrate because of the Thanksgiving vacation. So to all of you, we wish you the absolute warmest and most loving holiday yet. Okay, last week we started including a new segment to the show that we have decided to call our Spotlight of the Week. This week's Spotlight has turned upon a new study suggesting that gaming together may bring our brains together. You know, you've heard me say repeatedly, neurons that fire together wire together. Well, how about brains that play together? Can they somehow wire together? According to a new article reported in Science News, playing computer games together makes brains feel and think alike. Scientists have discovered that playing computer games can bring players' emotional responses and brain activity into unison. By measuring the activity of facial muscles and imaging the brain while gaming, the group found that people go through similar emotions and display matching brain waves. Quoting, "It's well known that people who communicate face-to-face will start to imitate each other. People adopt each other's poses and gestures, much like infectious yawning. What is less known is that the very physiology of interacting people shows a type of mimicry, which we call synchrony or linkage." Close quote. In the study, test participants played a computer game called Hedge Wars, in which they managed their own team of animated hedgehogs and interns shot the opposing team with ballistic artillery. The goal was to destroy the opposing team's hedgehogs. The research team varied the amount of competitiveness in the gaming situation. Players teamed up against the computer, and they were also pinned directly against each other. The players were measured for facial muscle reactions and brainwave activity. Replicating previous studies, they found a high linkage in the facial muscle reactions as well as in similar brainwave patterns. They further observed that this linkage in the brainwave activity increased. A striking discovery indicated further that the more competitive the gaming became, the more in sync the emotional responses of the players. The test subjects were to report emotions themselves, and negative emotions were associated with the linkage effect. Now, quoting again, although counterintuitive, the discovered effect increases as a game becomes more competitive. And the more competitive it gets, the more the players' positive emotions begin to reflect each other, while all the while their experiences of negative emotions also increase. So remember, I have been pretty hard on many computer games in the past, especially the genre known as MMORPG, first-person shooters. Well, all first-person shooters for that matter. Now we see that the competitive games bring minds together, and the more competitive, the closer aligned they become. What are we to think of this? I mean, do we need competition to become one? Is it the enemy of my enemy is my friend, so I can feel positive emotions toward my fellow player under those circumstances? I have an idea. Can we invent something in the computer that challenges us, becomes our competitor, if you will, and use this to initiate some kind of global oneness? Now, that seems appropriate, you know, considering the fact that our show is all about one mind today. Your thoughts on this one?
I find the research itself fascinating. You know, I think there's a great deal more that they need to do on the back end. I know when you talked to me about it initially, you know, I was thinking, well, does that relate to watching your favorite team playing as opposed to, but I think actually being on the computer, your focus is a lot more intense. So
yeah, you're watching ballistics, you know.
But I think there must be something wrong with me. It's not going to help with my oneness because shooting hedgehogs on a computer will just bore me.
I don't know. The research disagrees, but, you know. All right. Every week I read some of your letters as our way of paying respect to the very important role you play in making this show successful. Last week our guest was Lisa McCourt. Andrew wrote, enjoy the show, and what a pleasant guest Lisa is. Molly wrote, Lisa McCourt seems so open and genuine. I loved how she explained things. Thanks for bringing us such great shows. Janet wrote, your syllogism analogy was most powerful. People will see and believe what they already believe. Wow, that is telling. Richard remarked, jolly good show today. I expected an excess of frippery. Now, that's a nice word, Richard. But instead, found solid content and sensible goodness. And I'm most curious about the writing course offered. P.S. Eldon's syllogism of syllogisms was awesome and fascinating. Travis wrote, glad to have you and Ravinder back. I can actually listen to your show on my old BlackBerry phone. I'll be looking forward to Wednesday from now on. Thanks for all you are. Barbara wrote, love the new 2-hour format. I'll get it out of my mouth. Carolyn wrote, I have used your brain entrainment programs with incredible results. I have also received the help I needed using your InnerTalk CDs. Thank you. Karen wrote, thank you for your beautiful work, Eldon. You have changed my life. Now, 2 weeks ago, I read a letter from Adele. Let me reread the letter since we have a rather strong rebuttal that I will share with you in just a moment. Adele wrote, quote, I have been a regular listener to your shows over the last few months and have even started listening back through the archives to get my fix. I am predominantly housebound most of the time due to health issues and really enjoy listening to your interviews, which I find incredibly thought-provoking, inspiring, and uplifting. I consider myself an open-minded, spiritual person, and I am often drawn to the weird and wacky, yet I am also quite left-brained, analytical, and rational. I get increasingly frustrated with a commercialized New Age brand of spirituality, which I feel has, to a large extent, been commandeered and co-opted by slick-talking, money-driven, egotistical, self-appointed gurus, many of whom do not walk the walk and instead peddle, recycle, and rehash the same old hocus-pocus in cleverly marketed, sparkly new packaging with very little substance or evidence to support it. She continues, I am often taken aback listening to many live shows with these New Age pop stars whose egos are very quick to make an appearance when they are questioned or challenged on even the most trivial of issues. I feel that, sadly, authenticity is lacking greatly amongst many of them, and believe many vulnerable people who are truly in need are taken in and often taken advantage of in their desperation to find solutions to the difficulties they face in their life. In contrast, I find your shows a refreshing listen, and I have already recommended them to friends and family on the same wavelength. Before even knowing what a show is about, I am confident that your chosen guest will have been thoroughly researched and discernibly chosen. I very much appreciate your no-nonsense style of interviewing and get a laugh when you ask the hard questions that I am also thinking. Close quote. Okay, now, you know, that's Adele's letter. Now, in response and by way of contrast, rebuttal, you might say, Denise wrote, I normally turn the channel when your show comes on. Sorry, but while listening to 1-2 Radio yesterday, I caught the opening of your show and tried to give myself a second to listen. But before I turned the channel, I was shocked to hear you read letters from viewers and spend so much time on blasting the New Agers and trying to justify your beliefs as right, righteous, more like, over the other co-hosts on the very channels you broadcast from. I found that so unprofessional of you and your co-host to blast or insult the others who work in this industry. Just because you are not able to grasp something or prove it scientifically does not mean it's something to insult. I agree some of the New Age leaders may come off as egotistically, but so do you, Eldon, in putting them down and acting like only your beliefs are of importance. Anyway, I had to share because it irked me to hear you go on and on. Normally, I don't listen to your show as I am one of those New Agers who grasp abstract concepts. I also have to giggle that your voice sounds like that skit from SNL, Grumpy Old Man. Anyway, I know you have your place too, but please try not to insult others who are helping people just as much as you are, and it's bad business to insult your coworkers. Close quote. Well, you know, first, thanks for the letter, Denise. I like all the letters. I like the feedback. I do not think I went on and on, but I did agree that there was a lot of merit to Adele's letter. That said, I would say that I'm sorry for what I'm about to say, but that would be only so much maudlin pablum designed to tell the folks what they want to hear. If you think that grasping abstract concepts is the domain of New Agers, you're really imbibing Kool-Aid, girl. I don't try to tell folks what to think or believe other than to point out what hard research has shown. So I readily encourage such things as a strong spiritual connection, mindfulness training, meditation, and so forth. However, I am also not at all hesitant to point out cognitive dissonance, faulty reasoning, flawed logic, baffle gab, and the like. I used psychics when I was an investigator, and some are truly gifted while others are a fraud. People lie. That's all there is to it, Denise. In my opinion, our ability to think is a gift, not a plague. Still, I recognize the fact that our subjective experiences are inherently private. As such, if someone informs me of their experience, who am I to challenge that? On the other hand, tell me something about what science is supposed to say or prove. Have it wrong, and I'll call you out on it. Tell me something philosophical, like there are no universal values, and I'll give you the opportunity to defend that position by illustrating the implicit nature of your statement. Provocative Enlightenment is not a feel-good show per se. The show exists to inquire, to ask questions, to expand horizons, and to debunk the nonsense. If you have it all down pat, you already know the limits and limitations, or there is no interest in honest inquiry, then this show is not going to be your cup of tea. Now, one last point, Denise. I have never been one to put money-making business above honesty and integrity, so I will continue to call it as I see it, and when I get it wrong, I'll apologize, for I know all too well how little any of us really know. Comments on Denise's letter, Ravinder?
You know, I do find it fascinating. I mean, by any normal standards, you and I are New Agers. I mean, I've talked on the air about my interest in crystals, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to follow everyone out there who is using crystals for everything. You know, for you and I, it is all about the search for the truth and our industry, our field. There are lots of snake oil salesmen and, you know, people who are less than truthful. And for you and I, the whole thing is not about being the experts in the field. It's about searching for the truth. And when there are flaws in it, I hope you do call it out. That's been my journey with you for the last 20 odd years. And that has been totally invaluable. I want to grow. I don't want to just remain in the same spot thinking I know everything. I want to discover the truth, and the truth is so much bigger, so much.
Okay. That's all the time we're going to take for letters today, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to eldon@ellentaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming. And once again, I both appreciate and thank you for your feedback and continued support. Now, to this week's show, I've been looking forward to this one. One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of Our Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters. You know, this is a subject that has fascinated me since I was a very young child. Carl Jung addressed the idea of one mind as the collective unconscious, but although we could tap into this collective, it wasn't exactly the active, dynamic, thinking mind, also called the universal mind by the likes of George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel or Ernest Holmes. Now, universal mind is thought of as the universal higher consciousness or source of being in some forms of esoteric or new thought and spiritual philosophy. It is also often regarded as omniscient, omnipotent, omnificent, and omnipresent. Additional definitions view universal mind as a non-local and atemporal hive mind of all aggregates, components, knowledges, constituents, relationships, personalities, entities, technologies, processes, and cycles of the universe. Under this last definition, even the Akashic Record or library containing all of our life history is contained within the universal mind. Okay, now wrapping your head around all of that might take a moment. Many of the meanings are simply illogical and others are false by definition. Still, the idea that one mind somehow holds, contains, perhaps even originated the all of it all is a powerful idea, if nothing more than a myth. Now, before I offend anyone, let me explain what I mean by a myth. Myths address existential problems that we all deal with in life. Matters such as where did it all originate and why? What is life about and does it have a purpose? These are the sorts of existential problems myths are designed to handle. In at least one sense, science is a myth, for it, like all the other myths, seeks to explain the world we live in, to make sense of it all. Our brains demand that. We are set up in such a way that we need to understand, explain, and find causation. Our operating system, if you will, demands that of us. And throughout history, myths have been our chief means of explaining our role in the cosmos. Enter today's guest, Dr. Larry Dossey, believes that the evidence is now sufficient that we can conclude there is absolutely one mind, and what's more, understanding it is critical to the evolution of our species. Additionally, his copy states, quote, imagine a united consciousness, an awareness of which all our minds are a part, and a potential way out of the division, greed, and destruction that threaten to engulf our world, close quote. Now that's a tall order. Larry Dossey, M.D., is a distinguished Texas physician deeply rooted in the scientific world, and who has become an internationally influential advocate of the role of mind in health and the role of spirituality in healthcare. Upon graduating with honors from the University of Texas at Austin, Dr. Dossey worked as a pharmacist while earning his MD degree from Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. Before completing his residency in internal medicine, he served as a battalion surgeon in Vietnam, where he was decorated for valor. Dr. Dossey helped establish the Dallas Diagnostic Association, the largest group of internal medicine practitioners in that city, and was chief of staff of the Medical City Dallas Hospital. Dr. Dossey is a diplomat in the American Board of Internal Medicine and has written more than a dozen books, great books, I will add, including his latest, The Last, The One Mind. Dr. Dossey has been with us before, so let's get him back in here. Welcome back to Provocative Enlightenment, Dr. Larry Dossey.
Well, Ellen, it's great to be with you. I don't know if I can live up to that or not, but I'll do the best I can.
Oh, I know you'll live up to it, and we've chatted about that all before. What have you been up to since we last spoke?
Well, I spend a lot of time functioning as a kind of a roving ambassador for the role of consciousness and spirituality in health care. And I serve as an executive editor for a peer-reviewed medical journal called Explore. And I spend a lot of time writing editorials. But my first love, Ellen, is sitting in front of a word processor writing books. So I always seem to have something in the mix in terms of a book. And the latest, as you kindly mentioned, is One Mind.
You know, and I love your books. You have a way of taking some, complex ideas and reducing those ideas to, very understandable and very concrete, you know, bits of information that transfer into ways that we not only can understand, but we can use to empower our lives.
Well, I appreciate
you know, around
that.
Here, we have three questions of our guests, and you know that, you've been here. Who is the messenger? What is the message, and how do we use it? One of the things that I like, you know, I kind of do this uncovering technique. I like to ask my guests what their favorite songs are, because I've learned that, you know, you get a little self-disclosure sometimes. You can have an individual who is, you know, preaching oneness and love and happiness, and yet their favorite song, when you listen to the lyrics, you know, it says something quite the contrary. Life, you know, sucks and then you die. So we asked you your favorite songs, and you shared them with me. A Little Good News by Ann Murray. He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother by the Hollies. Wake Up, People by Teddy Pendergrass. We'll play a little bit of those as we go today. And I'm going to ask you why those songs when we do. Now, you heard the setup piece, so you probably, we probably should begin by having you define exactly what you mean by one mind.
Well, for me, one mind is a domain of consciousness that is experienced as a hyper-real kind of sensation. It involves a sense of connectedness with what many people call all there is, a sense of oneness and unity with everything. And this is all marinated in a kind of sense of love and compassion. And that's basically it. This has been a thread of awareness throughout recorded history. You mentioned the Akashic Records, which go back almost 4,000 years. So people have been talking about this sense of oneness with all there is, particularly with all other sentient creatures, for as long as we have a human record.
Yeah, you know, and I, when we've got a hard break coming up here, but in just a minute. But when we, you know, come back from the break, I'm going to ask you about a personal experience I had, because you've written about different aspects that evidence the one mind. And one of those aspects is how we can ask a question and, you know, who are we asking the question of? Somehow we're getting an answer that's providing us information. In my instance, in fact, I'll just really quick, like, I'd lost a tall marble when I was just a boy. And, I mean, I was elementary school, kindergarten. And it just, it was the end of my life. But when I closed my eyes after school, I heard this voice tell me, you know, take 8 steps this direction, stop, take 4 steps this direction, stop, take, you know, how many steps this direction, stop, look down, there was the marble. You know, and I can remember that as vividly as though it happened just a week ago. How do you explain that? But you hold that thought. We have a hard break. We're speaking with Dr. Larry Dossey about his new book, The One Mind. Remember to join Ravinder and her team in that chat room. You can do that by going to provocativeenlightenment.com/chat. Do stay tuned. You do not want to miss what's coming up after a few words from some of our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Larry Dossey about his new book, The One Mind. Now, before the break, I kind of set up a situation where I've got two things to deal with. The first, well, listen.
Rolled up in a rubber band. One more sad story is one more than I can stand. Just once. Like to see the headlines say, not much to print today. Can't find nothing better to say. Because nobody robbed a liquor store on the lower part of town. Nobody OD'd, nobody burned a single building down.
All right, Dr. Dossey, A Little Good News by Ann Murray. Why is that one of your songs, sir?
Well, it for me is a huge dose of optimism. I find myself smiling and perking up every time I listen to that song, because it says that we have the capacity to go beyond all of the negativity and the things that really weigh us down 24/7 these days, and focus on the best parts of human nature. And I think there's not enough of that emphasis.
I totally agree. And, you know, music is magical. And one of these days we're going to do a show on just the neurological influences or effects of music. But it is magical. All right. I asked you a question before we went to break. And, you know, I know that you have treated this area. Flesh that out for us. How is that possible?
Well, actually, your example of finding that marble through spontaneous messages or insights from somewhere else, it's just a great example. It's an iconic example. It's as if you dipped into what I call the one mind, which in the book I explain what I think a purpose it serves, which is as a pool of information from which we can sort of select what we need at any given time to solve a problem. That certainly seems to be what you did with in finding that marble as a young kid. Actually, I use an iconic story also, Eldon, in which a woman found a missing beautiful musical instrument. It was a harp. It was an archival harp, a family heirloom, which was stolen backstage from the woman who was playing it in a concert. And this was reported by a good friend of mine who's a psychotherapist, Elizabeth Mayer, and it's recorded in her book Extraordinary Knowing. She went to the police to report that it was stolen and to get some help in locating it, but finally they told her to, you know, get over it. There was no way they were going to be able to find this stolen musical instrument. A friend of hers told her, well, you need to call a dowser, because dowsers, in addition to finding water, they often can find lost objects. So on a lark, this woman who lived in Berkeley, California, phoned a guy named Harold McCoy, who was a dowser in Fayetteville, Arkansas, almost 2,000 miles away. And he told her over the telephone when she called him, give me a moment, let me just go inside, you know, in my own mind and see if it can be found. And he, after about 60 seconds, said, yes, I can find this for you. He said, it's still in that town you live in, that Berkeley. He said, send me a street map and I'll tell you where it is. She overnight FedExed him a street map of Berkeley, California, and he told her, looking at the map, the street coordinates and the specific address on the specific street where it was. She went to the police, and they said, we can't help you. This is crazy. Besides, we don't even have a warrant. There's no reason why we should issue a warrant for this. They told her to get lost again. She put up notices in the neighborhood around this specific house, and she got a call from a guy who said, my friend has your harp. And it was in the exact house where the dowser had told her it would be. And so the guy got the harp from his friend and met her in a parking lot late one night behind a Safeway store and transferred the harp to her. She was a very rational woman, very intellectual, and realized, however, that after this event, the world just didn't work the way she had been taught. And she went on to do some great work in consciousness research, and her life opened up, and she began to have a lot more of these kinds of non-local experiences, I call them. And so this is one example of finding a lost object, sort of like you found a marble. It isn't supposed to happen. You know, you and I in university training, and anybody who's taken a course in psychology, will never find anything in the textbooks that even remotely resembles this.
No.
But there it is, and I think we need to come to terms with it.
You know, it also, it begs some questions, and so if we may, let's kind of flesh them out before we go on, because predisposed in your response, the idea that, okay, is there another explanation? Is it possible that our dowser is being aided, say, as a medium might say, by someone on the other side, as opposed to, you know, a collective mind?
Yeah.
Is it possible that, you know, the individual that took the harp is somehow giving off a psychic, influence, as some of the mathematicians would say that work with precognition, and that's what this dowser is picking up. I guess, you know, as a child, I thought to myself, have I got a guardian angel? Because my mother used to talk about guardian angels. You know, have I got a guardian angel? Is that who's telling me this? Because it was as clear as, you know, close your eyes, walk 5 steps, stop. You turn to your right, walk 9 steps, stop. And I mean, literally, there was no hesitation, no mistake. And when I opened my eyes, that marble was right there at my feet. So do you give that any kind of consideration, the possibility that Occam's razor may not necessarily lead us to one mind?
Yeah, I do. I think you can slice and dice the idea of the one mind in many, many ways. You can parse this and come out with different scenarios that might explain it. But in my judgment, all of those kinds of scenarios that you mentioned can be seen as iterations of the one mind. And it isn't of great concern to me which one people settle on. Here's why I think all of this is an expression potentially of a one mind. What all of these examples tell us is that there are no spatial or temporal limits to our consciousness. Whether we derive that information from angels or people on the other side, all of this is dependent upon a view of the mind which says that consciousness is not limited to the brain. It behaves as if there are no spatial limits. It behaves as if it isn't confined even to the present. There's a term for this that I adore. It's non-local mind. Non-local is just a fancy word for infinite. So however we want to dress up these possible explanations, we come in the end to what I think is very parsimonious explanation for what may be going on here, which is consistent with Occam's razor, and it's simply a non-local expression of consciousness.
Okay, now let me just make sure that I'm clear on this, because let's say we take the cells, divide them out of a petri dish in the lab, and as research has shown, take them a mile away. And then deliver electric shock to the shell of the cells that remain, the half of the cells that remain in the petri dish in the lab, while watching those cells a mile away respond precisely at that moment as though they were shocked. So somehow there's been this communication across distance, this non-local mind action. Does that necessitate, are you implying that all things, all matters of consciousness, right down to the cell, communicate somehow vis-a-vis this terminal? We'll think of it as this transceiver, universal mind.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. You know, there are actual studies now, like the one you mentioned, in which you can demonstrate that there's some eerie connection between various sorts of cells, even though you can put them at an arbitrary distance from each other. One that I like quite a bit involves human neurons, brain cells. In one study I go into in the book, these were separated, and they weren't just separated. They were put in something called a Faraday cage, which is kind of a lead-lined box which blocks all sorts of electromagnetic transmissions or communication between the two. And they were separated, and when the researchers shined a laser light on one batch of these neurons, instantly and in the same way, the other neurons, which were shielded at a distance, registered identical changes. Now, that's at the cellular level, and people may say, well, what's that got to do with me? And so researchers have sort of upped the ante, so to speak, and they have taken whole brains in live people and stimulated one person's brain and the other person's brain at a distance changes instantly in the same way as measured by electroencephalogram or brain waves, or you can measure the changes with functional magnetic imagery, a fancy type of scan. So there is human relevance. We're not talking about just individual cells. Whole brains register this sort of thing at a distance.
You heard the setup piece, Dr. Dossie, the study where the gamers were actually, you know, killing hedgehogs, okay? And the more competitive it became, the more coherence there was between their brainwave activity and their facial expressions. Do you see that as some kind of a, I guess I have to think of it as like a sub-frequency or a sub-harmonic within the total harmonic of what we would think of as universal mind?
Well, it seems to be a harmonic sort of relationship. I want to be clear to the listeners, however, I don't think there's any actual signal going between these gamers or, in the instance we were just talking about, between those isolated cells. People have tried forever to try to find some sort of energetic wavy vibration. None of that kind of modeling works for various reasons. Nobody's ever been able to find any kind of energetic signal. But as I was hearing you describe those gaming outcomes, I there was a part of me that isn't very happy about that. And
no, I know. Neither am I.
Yeah. You know, in the book, I've got several examples of coherent thought among distant people, which is not very nice. I talk about how a whole nation during the World War II situation in Germany, where people began to have coherent thoughts about a lot of things, but they were terrible, and it resulted in enormous tragedy. Irvin Janis, back in the 1970s, came up with something called groupthink,
right,
where, you know, people in these high-power situations at the highest levels of government all began to think alike. Nobody had any criticism about particular ideas, and some of those groupthink outcomes were just terrible. The Bay of Pigs is one that Janis used, and their inability to anticipate the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, which initiated our entry into World War II, was an example of harmonious thinking in a group. So just because people's emotions tend to reflect each other, then I'm not sure that's always a good thing. I mean,
totally concur.
My defenses go up somewhat when I when I hear that sort of thing.
Yeah. Now, implicit, I mean, in what you're just, in your last answer are two things that I have to kind of touch to. The first one is then you don't see an energetic exchange of the kind that we can measure going on by way of the loop system, whatever it is, cells to universal mind, human beings to universal mind, whatever that medium of exchange is, it's not within the domain of something science currently could measure. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, and would you like for me to give you a couple reasons why, real quick?
Yeah, please do.
Well, if there's an electromagnetic signal bridging the gap, it ought to get weaker the farther apart the two entities get by a particular law in physics called the inverse square law. We don't see that. You can separate these things increasingly, and the strength of the correlation doesn't change. So that's really solid evidence that, you know, there isn't any kind of electromagnetic energetic signal bridging the gap. Also, these changes, Eldon, are instantaneous. If there was a signal going from one to the other, they would not be. There would have to be a delay for the signal to bridge the gap from one to the other. We don't see that. We see an instantaneous change between these two distant things. The other thing is I mentioned on purpose there about that Faraday cage. If this was an electromagnetic, magnetically mediated signal, you could block it. These are lead-lined iron boxes, right?
Right.
And you can't block it. These are three reasons why it just doesn't make sense to hypothesize any kind of electromagnetic signal.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, so aside from the fact that people have tried to find a signal, you know, for decades, and nobody's been able to do that, so for all those reasons, this appears to be what we call a genuinely non-local distant correlation, which means that there isn't any intermediary physical signal that's going from A to B, where, you know, A tells B what to do. It doesn't work like that.
And I think, you know, an important point to make, just, you know, while we're on this subject before we move on, is that a lot of the skeptics, the naysayers, they'll turn to this kind of communication and say there's absolutely no evidence for it. We've run this kind of a study. We've looked at this kind, looking for a mechanical means by which this takes place. And what we're really saying is, well, you know, the pure fact that it exists the way it does means that it cannot be measured. And so the naysayer is saying that because we can't find it, they're actually evidencing in favor of what your hypothesis is. Do I have that correct?
You sure do, and I'm glad you put it that way. You know, this whole conversation is changing dramatically in the past couple years. The naysayers used to say that all this non-local stuff exists only between subatomic particles and photons, electrons, and all that. But that idea has been blown out of the water. In the past couple of years, there have been many studies now showing that biological systems also display these distant correlations that we've been calling non-local. So the idea that all this weird stuff is confined to the subatomic world of invisible particles is just no longer the case. You know, a lot of these skeptics, Eldon, have just not kept up. I mean, I say that with respect, but it is extraordinarily unusual to find any diehard skeptic who has even read the relevant experiments. So, you know, I'm happy for their feedback, but often it's not very enlightened.
Yeah. I think we should also discern there is a real difference between the cynic and the genuine skeptic.
Good point.
I see more and more skeptics become less and less skeptical. And so I'll add that in there. Now, listen, I said there were two parts to your earlier answer. The second part I want to go to is feeding off this collective, you know, how people can all have the same thoughts, groupthink, as was said. Maybe we have a contemporary version of that today, but it's rather split group thinking.
Right.
But we had a conversation, you and I did, about 9/11. And I've shared that conversation with several people since then, and it continues. I mean, I'm amazed at the number of people. I wasn't aware, but I'm amazed at the number of people that are still unaware. In your book, you talk about premonitions, and of course, premonitions are, that would be a solid piece of evidence for communication from somewhere. 9/11 seems to me to be one of the more powerful ones. Can you unpack that, share that with our audience?
Yeah. There are thousands of reported cases. If you go onto YouTube and Google dreams of 9/11 or premonitions of 9/11, you get thousands of hits of people who had, in many cases, just almost camera-like details of what happened, and they were so moved by them, many of them spoke into a video and recorded their experiences and posted them. I spent days when I was writing about this particular topic looking at these cases. Some of them really are eerie. They're so accurate. The question is, you know, is there anything to that? I mean, could people just have a lucky hit or something? A fantasy that can't just happen by accident to come true. from those kinds of experiences, I go to the laboratory and see if there's any evidence that people can see the future. If there's profound evidence that they can. The pioneer in this field is Dr. Dean Radin, who has written a book called Entangled Minds.
Right, we had Dean on the show.
Yeah. Dean has pioneered a group of studies called presentiment experiments. These are computer-based experiments which show that your autonomic system gears up seconds before a computer shows you a horrible, provocative image. You don't know what it's going to show you. It could show you a serene, beautiful image, but if the image that is going to be shown to you in the future is one of these horrible things, your body registers a response to that in the autonomic nervous system before the computer even decides what it's going to show you.
Right.
This is seeing the future. There are about 30 of these experiments, Radin tells me, that have been done in different laboratories around the world. So, we can't look at any premonition of 9/11 and on the surface, decide but whether it's valid or not, but we can match up what people tell us in their lives and their experiences with these lab studies, and we can say, well, maybe we ought to be serious in paying attention to what people say about their future visions.
I think one of the points that you brought out in our earlier conversation was just how empty all the airplanes were. Most of us think that there were full aircraft, but, people really did act on these premonitions and stay off the planes.
Well, none of those four planes that crashed that day were over 50% full, and some of them were as, let's see if I can remember this correctly, the overall vacancy rate of all four planes was 79%.
Wow.
I don't get on airplanes.
No.
79% empty.
Not even midnight flights, no.
So it would seem, that a lot of people found some reason not to fly that day. And we can't know for certain if they had unconscious premonitions of disaster. But on the surface, it seems like an idea that we should at least consider seriously.
And the premonitions themselves, a part of the universal mind?
I think so. Getting back to this idea that the universal mind is where all individual minds sort of unite because they don't have any boundaries. I mean, you can't keep them in a box called the brain, and they won't stay put in the present. And if they don't have any limits or boundaries, then it just makes sense to say that at some dimension they come together. And what has...
All right, I'm going to ask you to hold it right there, Dr. Dossie. We'll pick it up. The computer's going to kick us out. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be right back after a short station break.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you're just joining us, we're chatting with Dr. Larry Dossie about his new book, The One Mind. But before we get back to the show, I want to invite you to join me on Facebook. I post regularly everything, including some of my own thoughts about what's going on in the world, but mostly, the latest in mind sciences. And I love your comments and feedback, and that's a great place to get them. All right. Before the break, well, and once again, I left us with two. So, listen up.
He ain't heaven. He's my brother. So on we go. His welfare is my concern. No.
He ain't heavy. He's my brother. Why that song, Dr. Dossie?
Well, Ellen, it's really kind of a one mind deal to me. I'm an identical twin, and for all of our life, my twin brother and I have had a level of closeness that is just extraordinary. We have had exchanges of thoughts and feelings and even physical symptoms at a distance pretty much throughout our life. And this song simply reminds me of that, and how in so many of these distant exchanges that you and I have been discussing, the role of the emotional closeness and love between two people really accentuates the occurrence of those sorts of things. And besides that, I'm married to a twin, so my wife Barbara and her twin brother have experienced the same thing in their lives. And all of this is sort of a reminder to me, you know, that there's something about consciousness that can bridge distances and unite and come together in profound levels of connectedness.
No such thing as coincidence. Now, here's a guy writing about one mind that's been sharing. I had no idea you were an identical twin, or that I didn't know that your wife, your lovely wife, was a twin either. You know, that's quite a story. All right, before the break, you were explaining how this was an action of or evidence of universal mind. Did I cut you off there? You want to pick that up, or you want to go to the next one?
Well, I just emphasize that it's the one mind comes together because there aren't any limits to individual minds. And just to say it again, that's what we mean by non-locality. There are no boundaries in space or time. So somewhere along the line, minds unite and come together in unity.
Okay, now, that's provocative enlightenment. I see you're getting some flack from some Christians. And you're getting the flack because, well, you wrote a book about the influence of prayer.
Yeah.
And prayer at a distance. And, of course, you know, Christians love that. And so the book became kind of a mantra. It went through all the churches, and it should have. It's an important contribution, and I'd recommend it to anyone. That said, then you come back and you kind of, you know, if I may, you revivify what Emerson has to say when he says men and women are what? He said it this way, they're gods in ruins. You come back with a form of transcendentalism, that's what it's been called, the God within. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that criticism that what you're really saying in your new book is that there's a level of divinity within each of us that is a part of this universal consciousness, and that is why we have a connection to that universal consciousness, and that's what, you know, provides that impetus as opposed to, you know, the God perhaps of Christianity. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think certainly throughout history we have attributed certain qualities to the divine, to God, the absolute, whatever term we choose. And among those qualities are some that you and I have been talking about already. I think you used the term omniscience and omnipresence and eternality, omnitemporality, if you will. So all this, these omni terms are features that accrue to a mind that's non-local. It's not in a place. It's you can't confine it to points in space or time. So what we're saying, by virtue of the one mind, the non-local mind, is that we have shared qualities with the divine. This is a long way from saying that we're God, and I think a lot of Christians misunderstand that. I'm not claiming that at all. I'm certainly claiming that we share certain characteristics. And even in the New Testament and the Old Testament, you can find affirmations of this general point of view.
Sure.
In the New Testament, Jesus says, is it not written in your book that I said, ye are gods? I'm not making this up. And I refer to a lot of these Christian affirmations of consciousness coming together in the book. The fact is, Eldon, that almost every spiritual tradition, every major spiritual tradition has a place for this point of view. Certain spiritual traditions within Christianity. He talked about Christ consciousness, which is pretty much the same thing.
Yep.
And in Zen, it's called samadhi. The experience of the one mind in yoga Satori in Zen and samadhi in yoga. And in Sufism, this experience is called fana. So at least the esoteric, the inner side of spiritual traditions, the contemplative side, has long recognized this. And so I don't think there's any conflict with Christianity at all on this point.
Yeah, I don't either. And there are many other verses that I could off my cuff throw out there. But implicit in the traditional definitions are some really, you know, difficult ideas for us to get our hands around. When you say, for example, omnipotent, you know, we mean all powerful. When we say omniscient, we mean all knowing. All knowing kind of presupposes a destiny that's written, and so it challenges our notion of free will. How do you see this interaction going on with universal mind?
Yeah, well, I think that it depends on how we view the nature of time, whether or not we feel like we're locked into a trajectory that has to be played out in a certain way. I think the way to escape that idea of just an ironclad fate is to really think about what we mean by mind. I do not see time as flowing in one direction, and free will sort of hinges upon this idea that there is a directional flow to time. I don't think there's ever been an experiment of the entire history of modern science that shows that time flows in one direction, or even that it flows at all. If we can wiggle out of this idea of flowing time that goes in one direction, I don't think this issue of free will remains a problem. And predestination goes out the window for the same reason. So it just depends on how we think the universe works. For people who think that time flows in one direction and it's irreversible, I suppose that this free will can certainly appear under threat. I just don't hold that view of time myself.
Okay, so I just want to be sure I'm clear on this. Now, part of what you're saying, I think back to St. Augustine's writings on his account of time.
Yeah.
And, supposedly the answer to what did God do before he created the earth. It shows that it doesn't flow from a point. But if it doesn't flow from a point, then all things are known, and they're known simultaneously. Then what you're doing right now was known to be what you would be doing right now. This very interaction with me was at some level known to be something that would occur on this date in what we call time, and it was known to occur before what we know as time is time. Do I have that right?
Yes, actually, you just restated an idea that has floated around contemporary physics for a better part of a century. It's called the block universe.
And, right.
The idea overall is that everything that has happened or will happen has happened, and the reason that we get into this idea that things happen sequentially is that we just discover one part of the block universe and then another, and this creates an illusion that causality is a major feature of the world, and things happen in order, sort of like dominoes falling.
Yeah.
But, physicists are quick to say that there are many views of time, one that can confuse your mind, as it has often done mine, is to think about what they call closed time-like loops, in which what we call the future can circle back into the present and drag information from the future into the present, giving us the sense of having had a premonition. I don't want to get locked into any particular view of time, because it is one of the most difficult things to talk about. And even great physicists will tell you that our understanding of time is primitive. I have a whole collection of quotations from physicists who say time is just too difficult. I don't know what it is. So, you know, I think that we ought to give ourselves a little permission to be flexible about this issue of free will, because I'm not certain that we know enough about time to be firm and
It does leave some troubling thoughts with you, though. I mean, the philosopher and the criminalist in me both suddenly say, well, you know, how can you judge the person that that just committed that crime? Because, you know, anyway, I know you get that. So, go ahead.
Well, I agree with you totally. We make concessions in our culture to a linear view of time. Because if we didn't, we our culture would be a mess. Our whole justice system would fall apart, as you just implied.
Yeah, we wouldn't have a culture, a society at least. So, you know, your book takes on so many areas. I think, you know, I kind of want to highlight some of those. We usually use the last half hour to take calls and let our calling audience question you. So I want to run through some things, if I can, before we run out of time in this half hour. You talk about how large groups of animals, flocks, schools, herds, behave in highly coordinated ways, and you do so as though this is an evidence of one mind. Now, you know, I know that you are going to have already received some flack over that one, because that's not the current view as held. Flesh out your thinking and why you believe this is evidence, would you please?
Yeah, I stand on the shoulders of ethologists who have gone out into the wild and analyzed, for example, the movement of huge herds of animals. The example I used in the book are the great caribou herds in northern Alaska. Mm-hmm. The two ethologists, animal behavior experts who studied this, came away baffled. And they said that there's no way that you can understand the movement of these giant herds of caribou, which number the hundreds of thousands, by saying that they just one sees the other move and that one moves, and so this ricochets through the whole crowd. Because if you look at the movement on one end of the herd and the movement on the other side of the herd, they move simultaneously. There is not time for any kind of sensory transmission to move through the herd. They move as a unit. This sounds quite a bit like a common mind in this huge group of animals. The same thing has been demonstrated in schools of fish, which seem to move in concert. The same thing has been seen in what are called murmurations, these huge flocks of birds such as starlings, which seem to wheel and gyre in total coordination. So the idea that they're picking up the movement of their buddies and just conforming to that just doesn't seem to work. I've not studied these in the field myself, but I do lean on the people who have actually analyzed this with time-lapse cameras and so on. So it looks like one mind to me. Actually, I'm not the one who has proposed that. Rupert Sheldrake, a Cambridge British biologist, has come to the same conclusion. So at least I have a few shoulders to stand on.
Right. And of course, Dr. Sheldrake has taken his fair share of heat over that. We've had him on the show. We've discussed this. But since you brought up Rupert Sheldrake, you also talk about how our pets particularly seem to be able to, you know, understand us, communicate through this one mind. You know, Sheldrake writes very specifically about how dogs seem to know when their owner is going to come home in advance. And he's run a couple of studies on that. Flesh out your idea and how this attaches itself or evidences this one mind.
Well, let me give you the most drastic, extreme piece of animal evidence I know, which I think supports the idea of one mind. This had to do with a documented case of a collie dog that escaped when the family was moving from their home in Indiana to a new home in Oregon. And so they had just started their trip, and they had a rest stop, and the dog got lost. And this family was heartbroken. They could not find this dog, but they had to go on to the new home in Oregon. So they gave the dog up as lost, and 6 months later, here's the dog at the new house in Oregon. He finds a way to enter the house, jumps up on the bed with his master, and, you know, it's a heart-touching reunion of this animal who traveled something like 1,800 miles. And you wonder how the animal did it. You know, the skeptics would say, well, it's just coincidence. I just can't buy that. I mean, this is just too remotely improbable for me to accept that as an explanation. And besides, in the literature now, there are hundreds of these cases that have been represented. They're called returning animal cases. And some of them just knock your socks off. They just seem so improbable. I'm suggesting that there's some common bond that operates on some level of consciousness that unites these creatures of different species. The animal bond of dogs with humans has long been, in human history, considered extremely intimate. So it's not surprising that so many of these cases involve dogs.
You know, and there's a part of me that wants to think it's emotional, but you know, I'm an animal lover, and I have been blessed with some wonderful friends that were animals, and I have firsthand seen, you know, the so-called, you know, communicated. There's no explanation for how you're able to communicate what it is that you're communicating, and yet the animal responds as though they speak English and understood exactly what you were saying in these crisis or emergency situations. It, to me, you know, that is incredible. But I, you know, again, I would ask you, do you think it necessarily is suggestive of one mind, or are we looking now at kind of an aggregate of information that at some point just is so powerful that we have to consider the single, you know, simplest or explanation, and that would be one mind?
Well, I think this idea of an aggregate or a pool of consciousness that contains all information is an idea that whose time has come. I mean, there are many people who have thought about this who have been at the top of their game in science and psychology who have come to this conclusion. Actually, some of our greatest inventors have. Well, an example I go into in the book is Thomas Edison, who would qualify as a very creative person by anybody's measure, I think. And
absolutely.
Edison was very clear about this. He said, people say I have invented things. He said, I have never invented anything, which is a kind of a jaw-dropper right away. And he went on to say that my ideas come from the universe. He said, I get my ideas from the outside, not from his mind, from the inside. So, you know, this is no slouch. There are, and I go into the book about this, there are many stellar figures in modern physics who have actually explicitly defended this idea of the one mind as such. One I emphasize is the Nobel Prize winning physicist Erwin Schrödinger, who said, in truth, there is only one mind. David Bohm, the great physicist in the 20th century, said, all minds are one. And he said, there is only one mind. And if we don't see this, it's because we're blinding ourselves to it. So my point here is, you know, these are not California woo-woo people who are just, you know, talking off the top of their heads. You know, these are some of the greatest accomplished scientists in the history of science.
You know, you be careful, Dr. Dossie. Say California woo-woo, yeah, you know, we'll both get letters.
Listen, I apologize, listeners.
You don't need to, I know.
I take it back.
Yeah, you don't need to. Okay, listen. The one of the areas that you talk about in your book that evidences the one mind, or what I think of as ghostly communications, what you call the acquisition of unknown knowledge from a person who died, and you know, there's no other way to explain it. But I've, you know, we have hosted some pretty solid medium researchers. And they claim that they're getting that kind of information from someone on the other side.
Right.
How do you square that?
Well, I am not. I just want to be upfront about this. I have never made it part of my journey to investigate in-depth mediums. For some reason, I just haven't done it. I really look to people who are expert in this, like Julie Boschel and Gary Schwartz and so on, who really have looked at this in detail. I quote those folks in the book, and I see no theoretical problem if there is a one mind where consciousness comes together, why that can't be true. I don't endorse mediums because I don't know enough about them. But,
Gary, you mentioned Gary Schwartz. Gary does, you know, endorse him. In fact, he's given a very specific endorsement to a public figure, John Edwards.
Uh-huh.
And Michael Tim has done a lot of work on this area.
Right.
So I guess my question isn't to put you in a place of, you know, one or the other. It's more to the notion of, do you think it's necessary that we have a spirit actually bringing the communication, or can we, you know, think of the communication as coming from the one mind in place of that spirit?
Well, let me give you an example which I think answers that. In the book, I talk about Joseph Chilton Pierce, who many listeners will recognize as the author of those best-selling books in the 80s or 70s called The Cosmic Egg, and then The Crack in the Cosmic Egg.
Right.
Pierce, in his latest book, describes an event which happened when he was in his early 30s teaching in a university, and he says he was obsessed with the idea of the relationship between God and humans, and he was reading a lot of Carl Jung, and he was just really into this whole area. And
you know, I want you to tell this story, so you hold that story. But once again, we're within 10 seconds of a hard break, and so I'm going to stop you before we get too far in the story.
Very good.
We hope you're enjoying our show today with Dr. Larry Dossey and our discussion about his delightful book, The One Mind. I highly recommend this book. You can visit his website to learn more about Dr. Dossey and his lovely wife by going to DosseyDossey, that's DosseyDossey, again, .com. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes and take your phone calls, so do stay tuned.
You're listening to Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Larry Dossey about his new book, The One Mind. We will take your phone calls in this half hour. So if you have questions of our guests, either give us a call or submit your questions in our chat room. Ravinder and her team, Andrea and Jana, are there to put your questions forward. Okay, back to the show. I think, Dr. Dossey, you were about to tell us a story inspired by Joseph Chilton Pierce. Pick it up and share that story with us, will you,
yes,
please?
Yes, well, you and I were discussing whether or not an actual entity, a person who
right.
is on the other side, is necessary for people to know these extraordinary things on this side. And so Pierce was really concerned about the relationship between God and human beings, and was obsessed with this idea, he said, and he wasn't getting very far very fast. So one morning he was preparing for an early morning college class, at which point his five-year-old son came into his bedroom and sat down on the end of the bed and began to deliver a 20-minute tutorial on this question. Pierce said that Du Bois spoke in publishable sentences using complex psychological language. He said he didn't pause. He spoke in a flat monotone. And Pierce said that it would be 30 years before he ever approached this level of understanding. It was demonstrated by this 5-year-old boy. The little boy's ride to kindergarten came, the horn honked, and he got up and ran off. And Pierce says that he didn't have any recall of ever having done this. But Pierce was just absolutely flattened by this. He was almost incapacitated. He said he started to weep. He was late for class and could barely function because he realized he had been in the presence of something uncanny.
Right.
So that's an example that I think is a pretty profound one, that people can just tap into what's been called the cosmic soup or the pool of consciousness and extract incredible levels of information without this being mediated by some personality on the other side.
And one of my favorite sayings, a poster that I've done some lavish framing with, it's in my office, is Albert Einstein saying, "I want to know God's thoughts, all else are details."
Oh, that's right, yes.
You know, the universal mind, evidence. Do you think that people that speak in tongues, we've talked about, the example that you just gave, but there are religious ceremonies around the world where people are moved and they're able to, through one means or another, speak out to the, shall we say, the glory of the universal mind or the direction. Do you think that all comes in the same kind of spontaneity as this 5-year-old boy that Pierce talked about?
Yeah, I think it's highly likely that that's the case. You know, most of these instances where people seem to acquire knowledge that they have no way of getting through ordinary means tends to pop up and come through them when they do something that turns their waking awareness off. It allows something from the unconscious to bubble up and manifest in conscious awareness, whether or not it's fasting, going on a vision quest, silencing the rational mind by speaking in tongues, or sensory deprivation of some sort. There are just a million ways in which people can learn to set the stage for the eruption of this extraordinary kind of knowledge in their lives. I mean, it's almost embarrassing.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dr. Dossi.
Well, I just want to say it's almost comical sometimes. I mean, I collected stories of people who had epiphanies, washing dishes or cutting their fingernails. I have a friend who said that he tapped into the universal mind one morning while he was sitting on the side of the bed. He'd just woken up, and he was looking outside at the rising sun, picking lint from his navel when he just tapped into it, and he said it was marvelous. He felt connected with everything. So, nothing's off the table as far as the technique, I guess.
Obviously, that would pique Ravinder. She couldn't hold that laugh.
I heard that laugh, Ravinder.
Yes, good. David Peet, in his book Serendipity in Science, talks about how scientists can be working on projects in solitary, say, within the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, at the same time, maybe, in a Western nation, and have the same breakthrough at the same moment. He calls this synchronicity. Do you see that as some kind of connection to a universal mind?
I think it's a one-mind event. There's some sensational examples of that. Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace,
right,
came up with the idea of survival of the fittest practically simultaneously.
And they, Wallace was a little in front of him, but yeah.
Okay. And they, as far as I know, they had no contact with one another, and gosh, there are just any number of cases like that.
You know, I'm going to try this on you. I've always kind of thought, since I was very small, and I don't know where this idea originated from, of the mind as being like a transceiver, like a radio transceiver, and there being this collective, and your ability to tap into it was really depended upon, as with a radio, where you tuned your mind to. You could tap into some pretty ugly stuff, such as what perhaps you were pointing out took place in Germany in Second World War era, or you can tap into some really beautiful stuff. Or maybe, you know, minds that are thinking along the same way can actually help one another solve problems because that transceiver is passing through the universal mind. Does any of this make any sense? Does this fit at all with what your work and your research says?
Very much. You know, I think you and I are on the same channel here. I want to point out that other great people have been on this channel too. One of the great metaphors that still stands and is becoming increasingly popular is that the brain functions as some sort of receiver or transceiver, picking up information from the one mind, the pool of information that's out there. One of the people who held this view was William James, who is known as the father of American psychology.
Yep.
And this has this idea of the brain as sort of an instrument that receives but does not originate consciousness is becoming fairly popular. Rupert Sheldrake, whom you and I have mentioned here, also is a proponent of this idea. He uses the metaphor of the television set. He says, you know, David Letterman is not in the television set. The television set does not make that image. The image comes from outside, and it's just picked up and elaborated and smoothed out and so on, and it pops up on the screen. Nobody would say that the television set makes the image. But, you know, in our materialistic culture, we do say that consciousness has made, the brain makes consciousness. I think that's terrible logic myself. And so I align myself with your view and with the view of William James and Henry Bergson and many other people who saw the brain as a transmitter, not an originator of all this stuff.
Right. I have to ask you this. Your book refers to near-death experience. And you evidence that, or you use it as evidence for one mind. You know, we have hosted all kinds of experts on this subject, and including, you know, researchers who argue that it's not a lot more than the reticular activating system kicking off, the same kind of event that we have when we have a dream. So how do you see NDEs as evidencing universal mind?
Well, I think the skeptics need to look at this more critically than they have. There's a book by Chris Carter, a British.
Right, we've had Chris on the show.
You know, he has demolished almost all of these, maybe all of these skeptical rebuttals about near-death experiences being the function of just a sick or dying brain.
Right.
And his book is called Science and the NDE Experience, and it's great if anybody wants to pursue this area. I think that these people do acquire a profound sense of oneness with all things. That's what they come back, that's what they tell us. This is usually marinated in a sense of profound love and a sense of perfection. And one thing that it strikes me about this is that these people, having had this experience, never go back thinking in the old way. This is a totally transformative experience for these folks. And in this sense, the near-death experiences are very similar to life-changing epiphanies that normal people have who are not sick. The fact is, and this is almost always neglected by critics, the majority of these kinds of transformative experiences that near-death people report are experienced by people who are not sick. So you cannot use the sick brain hypothesis to explain away all of these things. So I think we need to listen up about what these people have to tell us. there's cultural influences. You know, many people in Hindu countries don't see Jesus during their near-death experience and that sort of thing. But the core experience usually is that of unity and oneness, as we've been talking about with this idea of the one mind.
You know, you basically argue, if I've got it right, that emotion brings us closer together, positive emotion,
yeah.
Love. I'm going to use the word love. And if we would, for all intent and purposes, you know, join more in this love, that we would maybe, using our analogy, tune these transceivers in a way that we could end the disputes and quarrels and whatnot that we know of our day. Do you want to unpack that for me? I mean, for our audience, how does that happen when you have such divergent views about the nature of the universe, the teleological, the existential, to say nothing of the spiritual?
Well, I think there are fundamental ways to approach this. I'm a proponent for turning all of the world governments over to women. I think they're more loving, more compassionate, and I think they're less combative. And
I wouldn't object to that. I'll vote for that one too, Dr. Dossie.
Well, good. I'm glad we're on the same channel here. But I think that it sort of gets back to what Alice Walker, the great novelist, said once. She said, anything we love can be saved. And I think that includes the environment. I mean, we're in a mess as far as the ecology is concerned on this planet. And I think it just boils down to how much we love something. And not just one another, but all sentient life. And I think this idea of the one mind, which is can be a transformative experience in which we feel connected and loving with all sentient life, could catalyze a real transformation in how governments relate to one another and how we respond to the environmental challenges that we face. I think that this idea of oneness and unity marinated in love is potentially transforming of our life on this planet. I think it offers huge hope, but more than hope, because so many people have experienced this already, and it makes a huge difference in how people live their lives. So I'm all for one-mind experiences of people who have anything to do with government. If I had my way, would require that before we ever elevated anybody to a high level in the bureaucracy.
I've often argued, particularly recently, that the pronoun I creates a real impediment to the way we think. You know, not all languages incorporate I. But, you know, it's one of the first things that we learn. There's I, and then, of course, there's you. And then there's everything else. You know, there's the table and the house and the car. And in that way, we separate ourselves right from the very get-go, from the collective, from the total, from the necessarily interconnected way that, you know, the who of who we are. I mean, if I had an automobile, And I took the brake shoes out, and I took the fan belt off, and I took the distributor cap off, and I set them alongside the automobile. You saw me do that. You would know what those parts were. But if you had never seen an automobile, and I handed you a distributor cap, you wouldn't have a clue as to what that was. Well, we tend not to see ourselves as the whole, the automobile. We tend to see ourselves as this isolated part. And in doing so, we don't just deceive the way we think about the nature of the universe. We deceive, I believe, the potential of who we might become. Dr. Dossie, out of the chat room. Mod Girl says, my question, I would love for Dr. Dossie to comment on the culture of victimization and how that affects the global mind.
Victimization.
Yeah. Being a victim, yeah.
Well, it gets back to this idea of the isolated self aggressiveness, one person pitted against another. I think that there's enough wisdom in the one mind to transcend that way of thinking. And if I could just segue into something I want to get said before we run out of time.
Oh, please do, yeah. You can say anything you want. This is provocative enlightenment.
Okay. This idea of isolation and this fetish that we have made in our culture over self-responsibility, I think generates a tremendous amount of fear. We fear death. We fear the total annihilation of all that we are with physical death. And I believe that this is hugely destructive. And it leads to this idea that before we die, we've got to accumulate our stuff. And it's a pattern that has almost bankrupted us environmentally and ecologically. And I think that this idea of one mind is powerful enough for us to go beyond that, because the idea of the one mind being non-local in time points like an arrow to immortality, to eternality, to the old idea of the soul, some aspect of who we are that survives bodily death and couldn't die if it tried. I think this idea is powerful enough to sort of remediate this fear that is at the center of so many of the problems that we face in life. So there are many nuances of this one mind idea, Eldon, and I just think this idea of immortality should be right up at the top.
You know, I think one of the things our culture fails at, just completely fails at, is preparing us for the idea of death. It's something that we hide from ourselves. We go about as though we're bulletproof and the world will never end. And you know, and we really don't want to think about death for the most part in our culture. So, you know, Freud's right. We end up with a Thanatos urge. You know, we end up teasing death. We end up doing dangerous things just to show that we're still alive and that we really are bulletproof. And I think, as the Buddhist philosophy teaches, there is no way in the world you will ever live an authentic life until you square yourself with the terminal nature of the life you're living. You know, we really need to understand that we are going to pass through this phase, and the meaning of our life, the purpose of our life, something that we can have a role in defining, I'm convinced of that, is not about what we accumulate. It's not about our awards, our diplomas, our automobiles, our swimming pools, our on and on and on. It's really about what we do with our life, how we help one another. To me, that's what life's really about. That's where I get my warm fuzzies, and I know that's where you get yours as well.
The best things in life are not things.
I like that. That's very well said, Dr.
Rossi. You know, I love the old Buddhist saying that if you die before you die, then when you die, you will not die. And that sounds like gobbledygook, but it's really profound, and it says that if we can die to this idea that the self is all there is, then that is a springboard to the realization that we were immortal all along. And that's one of the most significant things that we can understand on this side, in my judgment.
I so totally agree. It reminds me of the Tao Te Ching, chapter 11. Wheel has 30 spokes. You know, when you think about it, you ask somebody to describe an old wooden wheel, they'll tell you about the spokes, they'll tell you maybe about the outer ring being wrapped with a metal band. You ask them to describe, say, a vase, they'll tell you maybe it's 18 inches high, it's green, it's made of alabaster. You ask them to tell you about a home, they'll tell you, oh, it's a brick home with, what, a shingle roof or something. What they fail to see is the hole in the wheel that makes it possible for that wheel to have a utility, because without that center hole, you can't, you know, without that hub, you can't put it on an axle. Yeah. It serves no purpose. And what is a vase but some, you know, it's the space in the vase where I put the water or the flowers or however you use it. It's the space that makes it usable. And we fail to see that part of our lives, that part of the world, we become so focused on the things in the world.
Beautifully put. I couldn't agree more.
Sir, I should have asked you this right off the get-go, but what prompted you to write this book?
Actually, the thing that goes farthest back as a factor in that book is growing up an identical twin. And I mentioned this earlier, but I knew from a long time ago that there was something about our consciousness that operates at a distance because of the experiences that my twin brother and I have had all of our life. And also, I had a series of precognitive dreams my first year in practice of internal medicine, which just totally shook me up about how consciousness has no boundaries to it and can understand things into the future before they even happen. But the thing that made me put my name on a book is the data, the science that comes out of laboratories these days, which shows that, you know, this is not fantasy. This is not something that we just make up. There's real evidence here, empirical evidence, as we say, that we're not fooling ourselves when we talk about these things.
It is a wonderful book, Dr. Dossi. I love the book. Any last thoughts that you want to leave with our audience?
Well, I hope people will focus on the ways that the one mind can manifest in their lives. And if you want to access it, I just say don't try too hard, because, you know, it's the sort of thing that sort of does us. We don't do it. But if you want to access this, just declare an intention. You're ready for it. You want it to display in your own life. And I just say get ready for a transformation.
I love it. Do you encourage meditation, or do you have any tips on how people can do this?
I think, you know, anything people want to do that quiets the surface mind is going to make you more prone to a one-mind experience. And the methods are just legion. Certainly meditation is one that probably has helped more people than any other specific method. But you can achieve the same place by taking walks in nature. I find nature exposure is one of the most potent pathways for myself, and has been all of my life. So experiment. You know, read books about what this experience has been like for other people and how other people have lived into this.
Nature is wonderful. Sorry, we're out of time, Dr. Dossi. You know, you want to get the book. It is called The One Mind. And you want to visit Dr. Dossi's website. It's loaded with information. That is Dossi, D-O-S-S-E-Y, Dossi, D-O-S-S-E-Y, DossiDossi.com. I'm sorry, but we've come to the end of another hour, another episode of Provocative Enlightenment. I've said hour for so long, but we're now 2 hours. I want to thank our guest and all of you for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed our show and will join us again next week, same time and same place. And do tell your friends, have them join us as well. And remember, if you have comments on our show, do please let us know. Okay, until next time, wherever you are in the world, besides connecting to that one mind, remember, believing in yourself always matters.
Provocative Enlightenment has been brought to you by Progressive Awareness Research and other sponsors. Provocative Enlightenment is a syndicated show and appears on other networks. For a schedule of show times, visit ProvocativeEnlightenment.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, write to Eldon at EldonTaylor.com.